Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 30th, 2010. Thanks for joining us. Once the month of August hits, you know summer is almost over. And as if you needed any reminding, the ads for back-to-school sales are already underway. Back-to-school for some means packing up for college. And just because you paid your tuition bills does not mean the pain is over. In fact, it's just starting. The average price of a new textbook has gone up 7.5% the past 2 years in a row. But a new law aims to soften that blow. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
Michael Spinelli studies drama at New York University. He'll be a sophomore this fall. Standing outside the library, he recalls one class that required 22 books.
A lot of them were like over $100. Like it ended up being like almost $1,000 in textbooks last semester.
The average college student spent more than $600 on textbooks last school year. That's according to consumer research group Student Monitor. The new law forces publishers to unbundle books so you don't have to buy the DVD and study guide with your psychology text. It asks colleges to give students a list of required books when they register for classes. That way they'll have months rather than a few weeks to shop around for the best deals.
Students can literally save hundreds by shopping around online for used books or renting. So at least the savvy ones are going to get a huge advantage from that.
Nicole Allen is textbook advocate for the Student Public Interest Research Groups. She says the law also makes publishers tell professors how much books cost before they had to ask or hunt for prices online.
What they'll have now is the information on the table right in front of them. So having that information will make it very easy to consider cost on behalf of students.
And if they do, Allen says that could pressure publishers to lower their prices. But will professors really change their reading lists?
Probably not that much.
Mark Tuckerman teaches chemistry at NYU. He says he'll continue to assign what he sees as the best books. His favorite runs $173 at the university bookstore, more if you throw in a study guide and student access kit, whatever that is. Tuckerman would rather see publishers offer students different versions, cheaper digital editions or loose leaf rather than bound.
I wouldn't be put in the position of having to think about the price, which I don't want to, right? I want to choose it based on content.
Textbook publishers say even before the law kicked in, they were offering lower cost options. Students can now buy some books online by the chapter or rent books for as little as half price. Bruce Hildebrand is with the Association of American Publishers. Even though new book prices are rising, he says students actually spend less today than they did 4 years ago.
They're finding bargains online. They are buying more used books, frankly. And they are beginning to purchase the digital e-books in particular.
Plenty of them aren't buying books. Michael Spinelli, the NYU drama major, says last year he and some friends got creative.
We had the same class and we all shared textbooks, things like that. Like my roommates and I, like we all shared textbooks just because it's so expensive.
At least they did the reading. Studies by the college bookstore operator Follett have shown that 15% of students don't buy the required books or access them at all. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
It's not often that the ripped-from-the-headlines sensibilities of Law and Order veer into something as banal as estate planning. But this year, as the series neared its own demise, one episode focused on the peculiar timing of a victim's death.
But how exactly did he keep Mrs. Casey's father alive?
He used chemotherapy.
And Belichick hates chemotherapy. He wrote a journal article denouncing it as poison.
He was trying to keep Louise Casey's father alive until 2010. That's the only explanation.
Why keep someone alive until 2010? Because Uncle Sam doesn't get a penny of the inheritance. It's a quirk, if that's the right word, of the estate tax law. And unless Congress acts, it goes back up to 55% for 2011 for estates worth more than $1 million. Laura Saunders covers taxes for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's a good year to die if you're rich?
Well, if you're rich, it is. If you're less rich, it's perhaps a worse year to die. And because of the strange situation this year, people were trying to stay alive into the new year. And when January 2011 comes, they might be hoping to die.
Oh, this just sounds absolutely bizarre. So let's talk about how we got to this point. How did we get to a situation where there's this one year, 2010, where it's all about death?
Well, it could only happen with Congress.
Yeah.
But you have to go back about 10 years. In 2001, an agreement was forged that the estate tax would get more and more generous for about 9 years, and then it would disappear entirely for 2010.
And when we say that the estate tax would get more and more generous, that means that it would actually be less.
It would, the exemption would be higher, okay, and the rate would be lower. Now, the assumption at the time the deal was done was that Congress would go back and change this so that the repeal would never actually take place. But procrastination being procrastination, they never got there.
So we were kind of joking about this, but did you hear of any stories where people literally tried to hang on until January 1st of this year, or are thinking, you know, I wonder if I should speed things up before January 1st of next year? Are we really at that point?
Yes, we really were at that point. Of course, now, last year, people wanted to live into the new year. People
right.
with about $4 million worth of assets, and that could include family farms and small businesses, were better off. And we have several documented cases where people just willed themselves to stay alive for an event. And lawyers say that happens, you know, for an anniversary or birthday. In this case, there was a woman in California who owned a family farm. And she was in a coma. She was diagnosed with incurable cancer in October. She kept waking up and saying, what day is it? What time is it? She made her grandson promise to tell her, even if her other relatives didn't want to tell her. And she died on New Year's morning. But there are other cases as well. She's not alone.
Okay. But of course, on the opposite end of that, that means that if you are in a situation of poor health this year, that you're hoping things will come to a conclusion before January 1st?
Or maybe your heirs are hoping that things will come to a conclusion.
Oh, no. Well, what are the chances, actually, that the estate tax will come back at January 1st? I mean, is there any sign that this is going to get taken care of before the end of the year?
Well, there's not enough of a sign. People are starting to talk about it, but Congress is really very dysfunctional at this point, and they were at their most dysfunctional on this issue.
So if Congress decides to reinstate this, is there any chance that they would make it retroactive back through this current year?
Well, that's what everybody thought would happen and hoped would happen, simply because then you would be dealing with settled law. We know what the law was last year. We even know what it is next year. This year is the big fat zero. There's no guidance from the IRS or anything. So there is the expectation that Congress will have to make it retroactive.
Do you know, are people actually starting to write their wills differently because of what's happened here?
They absolutely are. The problem is that people don't quite know how to write the wills differently
right.
in the absence of a law. And the lawyers don't know either because, as one said to me, we don't know what the law will be or even what the law has been.
Wow. All right. Laura Saunders of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for helping us through this.
And thank you for having me.
Time now for your letters. Last week, we featured a small item about a lawsuit filed against 99-cent only stores that have raised their price to 99.99 cents. We'll keep to ourselves some of the things you said about those involved in the legal profession. But Leslie Adamson wrote to say the 99-cent stores have saved her family. And the price increase is not hidden, she says. They say it on the loudspeakers. And more than one of you pointed out that Motel 6 charges more than $6 these days. We also profiled one specific feature of the new financial reform law, an Office of Financial Literacy. Listener Declan Sheehy is a financial advisor in Asheville, North Carolina, and had this suggestion for making us all smarter about money.
Maybe people could take a course in credit management or financial management before they go for a loan or a credit card or a significant purchase on credit.
Elsewhere in North Carolina, David Rigby of Winston-Salem asked whether the law included financial literacy training for members of Congress. Some of you objected to our recent story on mortgage modifications and why banks aren't doing more to help homeowners. Brandon Mitchell of Fairfax, Virginia asks, if they want banks to write down the principal when the value of the home declines, are they willing to share the profits with the banks when the value of the home appreciates? Doubt it. And finally, several of you weighed in on last week's call-in segment, where a listener wanted our advice on his pending midlife crisis. He knows it's coming, and he's planning ahead by saving for an Alfa Romeo. Catherine Amato von Hamert of Huntington Beach, California, waxed much more philosophical on the topic than David Lazarus and I did.
Everyone hits midlife crises, and we ask questions about, am I the person I wanted to be at this point in my life? And David seemed to see it strictly in dollars and cents terms. And while that's critical, for me, money is much more about values.
Meanwhile, 81-year-old Dorothy Miller of Washington, D.C. said our caller should go for it. She got herself a motorcycle when she was in her 40s. Better to fulfill the dream than be on your deathbed thinking, I wish I had, she writes. And Roger Woulette of Plainville, Connecticut, had a savings strategy to suggest.
That guy getting ready for the midlife crisis toy, I began doing exactly that when I was 42, and the pot of money became my toy. Started as a money market account at Vanguard, then that account became a springboard for a small but growing set of index funds. I'm 56 now, still working on it.
And Tom Fiorillo of Spionk, New York, had a warning. I was a mechanic who worked on Italian sports cars, he wrote, Ferraris, Alfas, Fiats. If you don't have at least twice the price of the car set aside for repairs, don't even think about it. We're hoping you think a lot about us. Write to us with those thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is MSN Money's Liz Pulliam Weston. Welcome back to the show, Liz.
Thank you, Tess.
Guess what? We have a Facebook page.
Yay! Oh, yay, finally. Good. That's so great.
All right. Well, so I will encourage everyone to go on our Facebook site and have a chat with us and hopefully find us indispensable, because I know that I am already, in just a week of being on Facebook, finding you indispensable.
There we go.
You and your 20,000 friends. How did you get 20,000 friends?
It
oh, my goodness.
It is amazing. I mean, I've been watching that thing grow, and it just blows me away. It's, you know, it helps to write for MSN because that has a huge audience.
Sure.
and people have been jumping on. But you will love having a Facebook page.
Why?
It is a great way to interact with the people listening to you. They will post questions. They will post comments. And most of the time, it's very civil because their real names are attached.
Yes, not like some of the emails that come through the inbox.
Exactly. Or the unmoderated commenting, which I hate, you know, because every troll in the universe comes out. But the wonderful thing is there's a community built in that wants to talk to you, and you get to talk back to them. And it's just, it's terrific.
All right. Well, so I will encourage everyone to go on our Facebook site. But in the meantime, we're going to do it on the air.
Sounds good.
That sound good? All right. Well, we've got Phil with us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Tess. Hi, Liz.
So tell us where you catch the show.
Oh, KNOW.
And what do you do there?
I currently work as a consultant for a community organization that does racial and economic justice. And prior to this, and why I'm a consultant instead of a full-time employed, I was actually working for a library where I was traveling in the Middle East and Eastern Europe and India looking for ancient manuscripts.
Ancient manuscripts?
Oh, how cool.
What did you do with those?
The university that I worked for is also a monastery, and monasteries have been preserving handwritten literature for, I think, about 1,500 years, and they keep updating their technology. And so this monastery got onto the ground in Lebanon and has been digitizing the manuscripts belonging to endangered Christian communities from the Eastern tradition.
Wow. Does that mean, what, taking photos of it, or are you actually transcribing text into some sort of document?
Taking high-resolution digital photographs. And then archiving those in several different spots.
Oh, that is fascinating. So why aren't you doing that anymore then? It sounds great. I love that job.
Yeah, it was
kind of, you know, a little Indiana Jones and a little Da Vinci Code, and the money ran out, and I was laid off. And so there I was, and so I decided, you know, I've got a lot of experience. Yeah, I have a degree in theology, which is not your more marketable bachelor's degree. I've been able to turn that into some pretty interesting things before that, so I decided to go into business for myself as a consultant, but it's been working.
So, Phil, it sounds like you've got everything in order then. How can we help you out?
So, as I was sort of moving things forward and trying to find what I was going to do next, I did a lot of things. I applied for jobs and kept running into the fact that a bachelor's degree, it seems, really doesn't get you anywhere. Mm. If you want to be in any kind of leadership, an advanced degree is now the price of admission.
So you want to go to business school?
Well, I applied to law school.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 36.
36 and starting to go to law school. Good for you.
Well, that's what I'm asking Colin about.
Oh, okay. Maybe not. What's the question?
You know, put in an application and I got offered a free ride to a local law school. So here's the situation that I'm in. We have a 9-month-old baby. I don't have any retirement. We've got about $150,000 in mortgage. We've got around $14,000 in consumer debt that we don't use anymore, but we're paying off. But as I start crunching our numbers, it looks like we're going to have to go into more debt in order to finance this law this next 3 years. And so we would be looking at having to borrow probably another $20,000 a year.
Oh boy. Well, Liz, right off the bat, that sounds to me like a whole lot of debt. There's no guarantee that going back to school is going to get you to a place where you're going to be able to pay it off once you get out.
Well, let me ask, what would the law degree do for you? I mean, how exactly would it help you?
A couple of things. One, I would have the opportunity to open up my own practice. So it gives a fallback career. And then combined with some of my past experiences, my thought is that it gives me an extra credential that might make nonprofit or others a little more comfortable saying, you know what, this guy's got a lot to bring.
Well, Liz, I think a couple of things to weigh. I mean, he's obviously done a lot of thinking about what this law degree could get him.
Which
once
is good.
Once he does graduate, you know, in 3 years. However, we've got a new child, significant household debt, that even if you're not adding to it, you know, you've stopped spending on your credit cards, it's still there until you pay it all off. And we're looking at taking away one of two incomes. That sounds like a recipe for trouble.
Well, it could be. What I want to know, first of all, is this deal the free ride for law school? Can you put it off for a year?
I can put off admission, but I would have to reapply for the scholarship.
So there's no guarantee you'd get that free ride again?
No.
Okay.
No.
Can you afford the house on just your wife's salary?
We could afford the house on our wife's salary.
But there's not a lot extra for travel, vacations, clothes, stuff like that?
No extra.
No extra. Okay.
Or any potential job loss on her part?
No.
So you don't have a backup fund?
We've got about $10,000 in emergency savings.
Yeah. You've got that, but you still have credit card debt?
Yeah.
Well, before all this happened, I would have said you should have used most of that savings to pay off the credit card debt. But at this point, you probably are better off with some kind of cushion if you decide to go forward. And I'm leaning a little bit towards suggesting you think about that. You know, this is the thing, that you are kind of rolling the dice here a little bit, but sometimes we get too afraid of debt. And we don't take the chances we need to take because we think, oh, man, you know, that's going to be, you know, more student loans or whatever. But
right.
Student loans, the federal student loans, tend to be fairly friendly debt. And, you know, a free ride at a law school does not come along every day. And if it's a degree that you think you can use, that you would be happy using, and that's the other thing, you got to make sure you'd be happy being a lawyer. There's lots of unhappy
really
lawyers
want to hang
out there.
The shingle.
Yeah. It's something to think about. And yes, it is. It's rolling the dice. It definitely is. But, you know, it's also kind of exciting, too.
Okay.
Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you, Tess. Thanks, Liz. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
You're welcome.
And next we have Jason on the phone, and he is with us from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
And how do you catch the show there?
I catch it mostly on the podcast.
On the podcast. Let me take a wild guess. I may be way off base here. Base? Get it?
Yes, right.
All right, you're in the military.
That's correct. The podcast is a little bit easier to catch in Afghanistan than National Public Radio's broadcast.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So you've been in Afghanistan then?
I have.
What do you do there in the military?
I am a military chaplain.
Wow.
How did you get into that?
It's a niche ministry.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like it was something that I was called to, but most of us, you know, all the military chaplains, we come from civilian ministries, and it's a pretty awesome opportunity.
What are some of the issues that you saw most with service members there? Was it missing home or...
You name it. Everything from the things we hear about, like combat stress, to missing home, to relationship struggles, and of course, just spiritual struggles as they kind of wrestle through deeper meaning in some pretty intense situations.
Did you find that it was hard at all for, you know, these tough guy Marines to open up to someone like you?
I think in general it can be difficult, but I think you get a certain cachet when you live with them, when you spend time with them. I often tell people that a hospital chaplain is usually not him or herself a patient. A prison chaplain is not usually him or herself an inmate. But a military chaplain is a member of the military.
Hmm.
And so we spend, especially in deployed environments, we spend 24/7 with the people that we're serving.
And I said the tough guys in the Marines, but I should also say I'm sure there are lots of tough women in the Marines.
That's right.
As well.
Tough men and women. That's right. That's right.
So you went through all the training that a military person goes through.
That's right. Yeah, military chaplains, like lawyers and physicians, go through a somewhat unique pipeline. We obviously come in with professional degrees, but we do go through our equivalent of boot camp and things of that nature as well.
So you had a drill sergeant yelling at you?
Yes. Yeah, well, yes, more than one.
Okay.
But at least you were maybe quicker to forgive him than others were.
That's right. Absolutely.
So is this something that you want to stay on in the military for a while?
I hope so, but that actually works into part of what my wife and I are wondering about and what brought us to Marketplace.
All right. Well, so then what is your question? Is this about loan forgiveness, perhaps?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Yes. Well, you are in the business of forgiveness, so perhaps.
That's right. That's right. If only everyone else was in the same business as me.
Yeah, exactly. So what kind of loans do you have?
Well, my wife and I have student loans, mostly from our undergraduate and graduate work, and we've been using some extra income to pay them down at an accelerated rate.
How much debt are we talking about?
Probably about $75,000.
Okay, so a good chunk of change.
Now, the loans are fixed at 5.5%, and we've been paying them quite a bit above the minimum payments. However, because I work in the public sector, I qualify for student loan forgiveness through the College Cost Reduction and Access Act.
Right. Yes, you do.
After 10 years. Now, even if I'm not sure if I'm going to stay in the public sector for that long, we're trying to decide whether we should continue to pay off the loans at the accelerated rate or just stick with the minimum monthly payment and invest the difference.
Hmm.
And every time we ask somebody this question, we get a different answer.
Yes, you will. Absolutely.
Well, first of all, what kind of savings do you have already?
We have an emergency fund, probably about 4 to 5 months of basic living expenses.
Good for you.
Both of us have 401k. I have a TSP plan, and my wife has a 401k as well.
Okay. Well, you know, Liz, this is a question that I think we get often in different iterations, which is, you know, should I keep paying down this debt, even if it's a low interest debt, whether it's your mortgage or a fixed rate student loan, or should I be taking some of that money, extra money that I was going to put into it, and set it aside?
Yeah, the attraction of paying off debt is, oh, I'm saving myself this 5.5% or 18% if we're talking about credit cards.
Right.
We need to look at the bigger picture, though, because most people aren't saving enough for retirement. I try to get the message across, everybody needs to make, or just about everybody needs to make, priority one, retirement savings. And once they're taking advantage of that, then they can look at, you know, the other debt that they should be paying off. Absolutely, credit card debt, payday loans, anything high rate. When it comes to student loans, though, if they're federal student loans, that's low rate debt, typically tax deductible, very forgiving, lots of different options to pay it off. And in this case, we're talking about actual forgiveness. In general, you shouldn't be paying off this debt any faster than you need to. And given your circumstances that you might get forgiveness after 10 years, you really shouldn't be accelerating those payments.
Right.
I mean, you can go on the income-based plan, which really gets your payments down, make those minimums, and then possibly get forgiveness after 10 years. Worst case scenario, you drop out of the military, you know, you can still pay off that debt over time, but you haven't missed out on other opportunities like the TSP plan, which the government retirement plan is awesome.
Right.
You know, really, you have great options. They're low cost. There's certain investments you can make that nobody else can. I mean, it really is a terrific plan, and I would try to take full advantage of that.
Absolutely.
Well, so I think the advice here is just keep going steady as you are and don't worry about getting those student loans paid off just in case you don't have to.
I really appreciate it. That's very helpful. And I think the advice kind of helps focus what some other people have told us as well.
Good.
Terrific. Well, thanks again for your service.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for the call, Jason. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. And next we have Melissa. She's in Waterford, Michigan. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
How do you catch the show there in Waterford?
I listen to WU of M. It's 91.7 in Detroit.
What do you do there in Michigan?
I'm a registered nurse. I work in critical care and a trauma 2 center here.
How long have you been doing that?
Almost 5 years. Went back and had a little career change. So.
You did? Did you used to be in the auto industry?
Well, I used to work in human resources, and I worked for an auto supplier, yes.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Along with a lot of other people there in Michigan.
Yeah, fortunately, I got into the nursing career before everybody else decided it was the hot thing to do. So.
Oh, I was going to ask about that because we always give that advice. You know, if you're in a dying industry, look at healthcare because that's a blooming industry.
Exactly.
but there must have been, was there anything in your background that got you into medicine?
Well, you know, honestly, I had always really liked the idea of being a nurse. It wasn't that I wasn't a good enough student or that kind of thing straight out of high school. I just didn't think I could handle all the life and death things and everything that goes along with nursing. And it wasn't until after I had my first child that I thought, you know, I can handle this. I think after you get to be a mom, you just have a lot more confidence in what you are able to do as a person. There's nothing that grosses me out anymore.
Yay, motherhood.
So how many kids do you have?
I have 3. We just had our 3rd.
Busy household.
It is a very busy household, yeah. And right now we've got 2 different houses, too, so that's part of my equation here.
2 different houses?
Well, I told my husband, I said, look, baby number 3 means bigger house. So the housing market here in Michigan is great for buyers. So we bought a new house, but we're keeping our old house to rent it out.
Does that mean that you're carrying 2 mortgages right now?
We are, which is part of the reason why I'm calling to see about kind of consolidating some of our... We're in a very good financial situation, but just kind of looking to maybe not be paying so much interest on some car loans that we have. So.
Some car loans. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're not asking if you should put the car loan on the house.
Well, kind of.
Oh,
we have
boy.
2 car loans right now. They're both at 5.25, and we have a little less than 2 years left to pay. And we have a home equity line on the other house, which doesn't carry a balance at all, and it's currently at 3.25. So my question is, does it make sense to transfer the balances from those car loans to a home equity line? But like every good idea, I'm sure there's some kind of financial pitfall to this. So that's why I'm calling you.
Well, first of all, Liz, this is a question that we got a lot, you know, 4 and 5 years ago. And
yes.
We called it the house is the ATM.
Yes.
Is this no longer a good idea? In their case, would you make an exception?
You know, there's so many pitfalls here. One is the issue of the interest rate. Yes, it's lower now, but that doesn't mean it will stay that way.
Right.
These are variable rate loans. As you know, they're just like credit cards. They can go up at any time. I don't see big interest rate increases in the next year or two,
mm-hmm.
So you probably have a relatively low risk. What I'd want to know is, will you pay off those loans in 2 years?
Absolutely. Yeah, I plan on continuing to pay what we've been paying.
Okay. Okay. And how much of your credit line would you be using up with these loans?
About half.
Okay. How about emergency savings? What is your stash like?
We could go about a year.
Wow. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, kind of do whatever you like then.
At this point, I got no worries for you, woman. No, seriously, the big problem was people were using their houses as ATMs. They were paying the minimum on these loans. So they used up what essentially could have been their emergency fund with foolish spending. You guys have shown the discipline that you need to properly use a home equity line of credit to pay off other debt.
Okay.
It really does sound like you've got it together in many, many ways. So Liz has given you the thumbs up on your plan.
Okay, good. Well, hopefully we'll get this paid down and get a renter in our other house, and we'll move onward.
Terrific. Sounds good. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you so much for answering my question. I appreciate your help.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you don't have to search through ancient texts or hospital records for answers to your personal finance questions. Just give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or email your question. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, or visit our Facebook page.
Yay!
Marketplace Money is on Facebook. Liz, thanks so much. It's been fun.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. If you've been thinking about making your house a little more energy efficient, you might want to wait a bit longer, or depending on Congress, a lot longer. A new energy bill in the Senate contains $5 billion for the government's Home Star program, including up to $8,000 for homeowners who make energy efficient retrofits. But if you do not want to wait, there are things you can do now to reduce energy use and bills. Marketplace sustainability reporter Adrian Hill joins us. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Tess.
So the Home Star program might help people who are looking to make some more expensive energy changes like a fridge or a dryer. But what can the rest of us do to figure out where our homes are using all that power, where they're sucking it up?
Well, it can be a little bit tricky. So I called Celia Lerman from Consumer Reports for her advice. One recommendation she had for homeowners is a little device called a watt meter.
Yeah. What is that?
Well, a watt meter is pretty neat. You can basically, it's a small device. You take it, you attach it to your appliance, and then you plug it into the wall. You let your appliance run, so your television, you leave it on as you normally would. You turn it off when you would. At the end of 24 hours, at the end of the testing period, it will tell you how much electricity your TV used.
And then what are you supposed to do with that information?
Well, you can judge if you maybe need to change out your appliance. Maybe it's time to turn it off. Maybe, you know, just to consider unplugging things. There are some things like your refrigerator. You got no choice.
Yeah, I'm not going to unplug that.
You can't pull that off the wall and let your sort of salmon rot. But but there's some appliances you can consider unplugging, and some maybe it's time to consider upgrading to something more energy efficient.
All right, so it's called the watt meter. That's one little device that you can buy. Any other gizmos that people are using to monitor their energy use?
Well, on a bigger scale, there's something called a smart meter. And you've probably heard about smart meters. Yeah, it's part of the smart grid.
Right.
And basically, this is going to help all of us control our electricity use. The idea here with a smart meter is that it's almost real-time back-and-forth communication with the user and the utility company about how much electricity you're using, as much as hour by hour.
Hmm. Is it a general rule that if you use energy on off hours, that it's going to be cheaper?
No, I think that's just in some markets. And okay. I think smart meters are helping people move in that direction. But I think that might be part of the problem, is that it's a new way to think about energy use.
So that would be like run your dishwasher in the middle of the night.
Right.
And
wake
maybe
up
get
at
a 2 discount.
Right. To save those extra dollars.
You know, one of my biggest energy bills is always, you know, when the warm weather hits and I start cranking up the AC. Is there any way to figure out a way to save myself money when I do that? I mean, I know I could just turn it off, but I'm not gonna. So
that's not a choice. Well, you know, again, this gets back to, like, how do you judge how your home is actually using this? Is your home letting the air conditioning, like, seep out? Is it all going up to your basement or your crawl space? Where is it going? And that's something that can be a little trickier to figure out by yourself. You can actually walk around the house and feel for leaks, maybe look for blowing windows.
I've actually felt that, yeah, because we have French doors along the back of the house, and I know that there's, like, hot air coming in and out of there when I have the AC on.
And so that's one place to start. But then you might actually consider an energy audit.
And how expensive is that?
Well, that all depends. In a lot of markets, a lot of utility companies will actually do it for free. And then the Department of Energy actually has a DIY energy audit that I've put up on the website for people to check out as a place to start. None of those things are working for you, you can call in a pro.
Thanks so much, Adrian.
Thank you, Tess.
And you can check out Adrian's blog, Easy Answers, at marketplace.org. A lot of us are so grateful to have a job in this economy that we would not dare think to ask for a raise. But if and when the time does come, one thing's for sure, women will have a tougher time of it than men. Because multitudes of studies show we are terrible negotiators. Last year, we aired a story explaining why that is, and we recently asked reporter Ashley Milne-Tite to follow up with some advice for how to improve your chances of success.
Kate Scarsella and her husband used to earn the same salary. They're both engineers. They work at the same company in Connecticut and started at the same time. 4 years later, her husband brings home $14,000 more than she does. Scarsella says it all comes down to self-promotion. He's great at it. Every time he has a review, he names his price.
And for me, I'm like, wow, I've done a fantastic job here. Thank you very much for noticing. And then kind of leaving it at that.
So why doesn't she push her boss on the money issue?
I think it's because I don't want to put her in an uncomfortable situation to, you know, go to bat for me. You want to make people happy.
It may sound crazy that Scarsella would pass up the chance of a raise because she wants to please her boss, but Julia Dawson can relate. She works in the fashion industry in New York. I first talked to her last year.
I'm just really shy standing up for myself at the end of the day. I think it's something that you're just not taught to do as a little girl, and I think, you know, for me it just causes me a lot of anxiety because it basically says, hi, I think I'm worth this and I deserve this.
Dawson says discussing her negotiating angst on the radio made her think even harder about how to do better. This spring, a former colleague tipped her off to an opportunity at another company. She researched fashion director salaries. In her interview, she asked for a 35% raise. They said yes.
And this is also a company that, you know, they only give 2 weeks holiday and they make you earn it the entire year. And I was like, no, you're giving me 3 weeks. And I got 3 weeks and they don't give it to anybody else.
The experience has done wonders for her confidence. But if you can't imagine being that self-assured under pressure, Sarah Lashever says you just need to master a few skills. She's co-author of the book, Ask For It.
Practice negotiating where the stakes aren't as high. Negotiate for lots of little things.
Like getting your spouse to do more housework or getting a reduced price at the store. Then build up to a salary negotiation. Rope in a friend or colleague who will play a tough boss.
So you ask for something and the other person acts like it's ridiculous. You're crazy. You're nuts. You know, I can't imagine that you think that's fair. Rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed, I don't know what I was thinking, you say, okay, I've surprised you, or we're clearly far apart. What do you think would be more reasonable?
But what if all this sounds like too much work? Sheila Wellington is a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. These days, she teaches negotiating techniques, but she was no expert back in the early 70s when she asked her first boss for a raise.
He looked me in the eye, and he said, I could get people like you for $10,000 a year and a hot lunch at noon.
She fled the room and didn't ask him again. After all, her husband had a good job. But a few years later, some of her staff approached her to complain.
Sheila, we're getting paid less than others who are doing the same work, and that's because you're getting paid less. You've got to get paid what you're worth. You owe it to your team. You owe it to your peers. You owe it to your kids.
Okay, so if all this has convinced you to go back to the table, there's one unpalatable truth you have to swallow. Sarah Lashever again.
When women are perceived to be boasting, their likability plummets.
She says bosses of both sexes are less likely to reward women who negotiate aggressively. Fashion director Julia Dawson knows from her own experience that it's a fine line. But she says keep smiling while sticking firmly to your guns and know when to stop talking.
Let there be pregnant pauses. Don't flutter like, you know, your boss is looking at you. They know these games. They're the ones that play them.
She says women just need to work on their game to become better players themselves. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Send us your stories about getting that raise, or not, at marketplace.org. In American pop culture, turning 16 means just one thing, the license to drive. But believe it or not, and I didn't at first, that may be changing. Studies have shown that getting behind the wheel just isn't as important to today's teens. What? Well, if you're in the car, you just let out a huge sigh of relief. If you're a parent, the sigh is coming from your wallet, Eve Troe reports.
meet Jamie Kittman of Nyack, New York, a self-confessed car freak.
Let's go for a ride. I'm the New York bureau chief for Automobile Magazine, and I'm driving a phosphorescent green Ford Fiesta, a car that's not even for sale yet, which I'm testing.
Kittman owns more than 24 vehicles, mostly hot rods. His son, Ike, is more freaked out by cars.
I'm Ike Kittman, and I'm 16, and I can't even imagine a day when I'd be okay driving a sports car. I mean, I'm scared.
You could chalk up Ike's reluctance as a case of like father, not like son, except both think it's bigger than that. Jamie says his generation couldn't wait to drive.
The first legal day you could be there, I was at the DMV, and that was pretty much the case for almost everybody I knew.
But Ike and his friends are in no hurry.
Only a few of my friends went to get their license when they turned 16 on that exact date. Most of them wait a while, and a lot of them don't even end up going at all.
The Department of Transportation confirms Ike and Jamie's hunch. Teenage driving has steadily declined over the past 30 years. When the DOT last looked at new drivers in 2008, only half of all 17-year-olds had a license. In 1978, three-quarters of them did. The steepest drop happened in the 1990s, when the most iconic image of teenage driving might have been this.
Hello? That was a stop sign?
I totally paused.
Oh, should I write them a note?
That's the 1995 movie Clueless. In some ways, that was reality.
From the mid-90s on, we noticed a real problem with teen drivers.
Laurette Stiles is with State Farm Insurance. She says crash rates went way up in the 90s. Car wrecks became the leading cause of death for teenagers. Many states passed tougher laws, bigger fines, and complicated rules for teen drivers. Insurers hiked their premiums. And Stiles says parents began to insist on newer, safer cars for teens.
The cost of the vehicle, the cost of fuel, the cost of the insurance, you know, they're certainly more expensive today than they were when I was a teen, and those costs continue to go up.
A family's car insurance often doubles if they add a teen to the policy, and Stiles has seen a big shift in who picks up that tab.
Our research shows many teens today are not primarily responsible for the financial aspects of driving, and that was a little surprising to us. Most teens, they don't pay for the vehicle, they don't pay for their insurance, they don't pay for the gas.
So if family finances are tight, parents are just holding off on letting the high school kid drive. But then they go off to college, still don't learn, and that's creating a new issue, says John Linkoff. He's managing editor at Consumer Reports.
It's much harder when you're in the professional world to find the free time to actually go out and take all the driver's lessons that you need to, and it's just going to introduce a newer driver group in the age 20 to 25.
The Kittmans don't want this to happen to Ike. He did get his learner's permit, but he can't seem to find time between extracurriculars to get his full license. And who drives him to all those activities? Dad. Dad would like Ike to be more independent.
I did bike like 7 miles or 8 miles to a friend's house a few days ago.
That would be probably the second time in your entire life that you've biked somewhere.
No comment, not true.
Ike says actually kids these days rely less on cars because they can socialize and do schoolwork online.
Your friend can just email you the PowerPoint presentation you're doing. Instead of you having to go pick it up and go study with them, you can just study over the internet.
What about working to buy a car? Well, jobs for teens are in short supply. And Ike says working would hurt his grades.
Because, I mean, I know if I worked from 3 to 7, I mean, I would feel exhausted and overwhelmed.
On this one, his dad, Jamie, agrees.
Well, I'm sure that my sterling character owes something to a bunch of crappy jobs when I was a teenager. I don't know that that's really the best use of my kids' time.
Jamie says Ike is missing out on the basic financial education that he got by working and paying for a car. But that's because Ike is looking further down the road. 16-year-olds today seem to think more about their lifelong careers than cruising on a Friday night. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If you're in Vegas this weekend, I hope you left your computer at home because you're there with thousands of hackers attending a convention called DEF CON, and they are really good at what they do. But you might be surprised at where they're practicing a good chunk of their craft these days. The information security group TrustWave says credit card hacking is happening at more and more hotels. Nicholas Prococo is with the company, and he joins us from Sin City. Welcome.
Thank you.
So should I not be staying in hotels anymore?
Well, no, not necessarily.
Okay.
You could stay at any hotel you want. What we're seeing is there's hackers have been going after data that's stored within hotels.
And how does that work? I mean, is that, you know, when you check in, you give them your credit card and somebody's standing nearby watching?
When you check into a hotel, hand somebody your credit card, they then swipe it into a point-of-sale system.
Mm-hmm.
So the computer system that the hotel uses to manage rooms and in your final bill. That data then gets stored within the system and transmitted over to their bank for authorization. And the attackers are infiltrating those systems.
Wow.
And basically waiting for that data to be entered. So they're waiting for the swipe. And when the swipe happens, they're recording that.
You know, the other thing that I have often wondered in traveling is, you know, when I hook up my personal computer or my work computer to the hotel Wi-Fi system, if I'm doing any sort of financial transactions on that, I've wondered if that is safe. Is that part of this as well?
And typically in hotels, the public network, so the Wi-Fi and the room internet access that you plug into,
right,
typically that's separate. Right? They should not be the same network. Now, okay. We have seen instances where those are the same network. So there could be risk there as well.
Wow.
Where if the attackers are on that network, they can now, if you leave your computer plugged in, say, in your hotel room, and then you go to dinner,
yeah,
and you're not up to date on your patches, and you don't have a personal firewall on that system, you could get attacked as well with your computer just sitting in your hotel room.
So then for me as the consumer, what are they doing with my information? Is this pure theft where they are taking my credit card numbers and using it to buy things? Or is there an element of identity theft here where they are then creating my evil twin?
Yeah, not necessarily identity theft. I think sometimes credit card crimes are confused with identity theft.
Yeah.
So if someone gets a hold of your credit card, they're not going to be able to go get a home loan with that.
Okay.
Right? So it is a bit separated, but they will go and they'll go on a shopping spree with your information.
So is there any way to protect yourself from this? I mean, you can't go up and demand that the hotel get a better security system, right? How do you even know if
right.
they have a good security system or not?
You really don't. And actually, last fall, I stayed at a hotel, and a few hours after I checked in, my credit card issuer,
yeah.
I actually got a text message that said, we had identified some odd activity on your card.
Somebody hacked you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
oh,
I checked into a hotel and my credit card got taken. So,
wow.
As a consumer, you know, from that perspective of that happening to you, there's really not much you can do. Now, from an awareness standpoint, you should review your statements. You know, look at all those charges. You know, many times when someone gets a hold of your credit card, they may not go and charge the $4,000, plasma TV. Right, they
right.
may only spend $2 just to see if it works.
They'll go to the 7-Eleven.
And then they go and buy a Slurpee, right? And they say, yep, the credit card works. No one's noticed that it's been stolen yet.
So now I'm going to head to the mall.
Yep, and then they go to the mall and they buy a new wardrobe.
So I guess the lesson, as always, with your credit card is to pay super, super, super close attention to your statements.
Yeah, from a consumer, that's basically the only thing you can do.
Nick Prococo is Senior Vice President at TrustWave. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, an exploration of why so many of us believe that designer labels are worth the extra dollar, or 50.
Consumers know that just because there's silk extract in the shampoo doesn't necessarily make your hair more silky. But in spite of that, they're willing to pay a premium for it.
No, I'm not. Pass the Pantene. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Angela Kim. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.